This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Linda Mottram from PM, your host for a series of programs we're calling How Did We Get Here? Each one taking stock of one of the big issues facing us. Today, our federal politics. 2018 marked a decade of leadership turmoil in Canberra. This year it was Malcolm Turnbull's turn to be turfed from the Prime Ministership by his colleagues. There have now been five Prime Ministers in the last 10 years, as we all know so well. The churn has destabilised the political landscape and disrupted progress on important national policies. While the coalition struggles to find its political direction in government under the helm of the new leader, Scott Morrison, the Labor Party has thrived in opposition, united by the prospect of returning to power at the 2019 election. Political reporter Melissa Clark joins me from Parliament House in Canberra. Malcolm Turnbull was brutally ousted from the Prime Ministership. It was how he came to the top job himself, but this is not a Liberal Party issue. The ALP has gone through its own leadership churn in the days of Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, of course. What is it about Australian politics that is causing a perpetual leadership crisis?
Well, everyone would have a different answer for that, but there are a number of factors here that all have to be taken into account. Part of it is the culture of the political parties that lead the nation. Some of it is the increasing focus on the leaders themselves and the personalities. And then there's the public disengagement and a fair bit of disenchantment with the political process altogether. There would be plenty who would point the finger at the media and technological change and how much a faster news cycle certainly seems to contribute to this kind of rolling leadership challenges that we see. All of those things combined have certainly been having an impact on Australian politics for more than a decade now, and we've seen those impacts yet again this year, and in particular in 1 week in August when it all changed once again.
Mr. Morrison, I invite you to take and subscribe the oath of office as Prime Minister of Australia.
I, Scott John Morrison, do swear that I will well and truly serve the people of Australia.
With the Bible and an oath, Scott Morrison became Australia's next Prime Minister.
You're now the 30th Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Australia. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It wasn't meant to be. The putative replacement to Malcolm Turnbull was not the conservative Pentecostal from Sydney, but the conservative ex-police officer from Brisbane. Peter Dutton was the one with the eyes on the polls and the numbers in the Liberal Party room. Peter Dutton saw weakness and began marshalling support. Malcolm Turnbull knew what was coming and tried to head off the challenge. On a Tuesday in Canberra, Malcolm Turnbull called the bluff of the Home Affairs Minister.
The result of that ballot was Malcolm Turnbull was elected leader of the Liberal Party by a margin of 48 votes to 35.
It saved Mr. Turnbull's prime ministership, but not for long. One by one, ministers who'd backed Mr. Dutton offered their resignations. Malcolm Turnbull declined nearly all of them, hoping to keep his enemies close. To no avail. 2 days later, Peter Dutton was ready to challenge again, confident this time he had the numbers. By lunchtime on Friday, Liberal MPs met again, and the majority voted to oust Mr. Turnbull. Peter Dutton, Scott Morrison and Julie Bishop contested for the vacant seat. The Liberal Party whip Nola Marino announced the final outcome.
The successful candidate was Scott Morrison, and he won this vote by 45 votes to 40 for Peter Dutton.
Standing with the new Deputy Leader Josh Frydenberg, the unexpected Prime Minister Scott Morrison pledged the turmoil was over.
We will provide the stability and the unity and the direction and the purpose that the Australian people expect of us as leaders, both of our party and as of our great nation.
He presented himself and his deputy as the serendipitous beneficiaries of someone else's coup.
Well, you're looking at two people who did not do that today, and who were very loyal and committed to the government that we were privileged to form part of.
Malcolm Turnbull stood in the sparse Prime Minister's courtyard at Parliament House one last time.
Because it just appears to be vengeance, personal ambition, factional feuding, whatever you describe it. hasn't had anything to do with 25 million Australians.
Family at his side, he left the office and Parliament behind.
So look, thank you all very much, and I wish you all the best. And above all, I wish the new Prime Minister-elect the very best and his team. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alice, come on. Malcolm Turnbull there bidding farewell to Parliament. Political reporter Melissa Clark is still with me. Mel, Malcolm Turnbull may have gone, but his departure has hardly solved the problems at the heart of the Liberal Party, the ideological divide that's meant the party's been unable to cohesively deal with important issues like climate change and a range of social issues.
That's right. It's not just personality clashes that are a problem here, although they can play a part. Policy intractability is a serious factor. Climate change and energy have been significant in all of the recent Liberal Party leadership changes, including back when they were in opposition. And that's symptomatic of that broader divide between the smaller Liberals and the Conservatives. Now, that's not new in itself. It's been a factor of the Liberal Party. Just think back to Menzies' Broad Church. The question really is, why is it different now? Why have those differences been able to be accommodated in the past, but under the current system, it doesn't seem possible?
So, Melissa, in 2018, Labor has been remarkably united behind Bill Shorten. What's the ALP doing right, and what lessons did they learn from their own period of political coups?
Well, there's nothing like electoral losses to drum home that old adage that disunity is death. But there are also some structural changes they made. For example, they changed the rules in the party, which mean the threshold is now different. There's a much higher threshold for what it takes to bring on a leadership challenge, and the Liberals have now adopted a similar approach. But it has to be a cultural change as well, because rules are things that can be overturned in the future. For Labor to keep managing this unity, which is going extraordinarily well for them at the moment. Whether that holds, well, we won't really know till they're under real pressure.
And of course, there's plenty of political theatre in all of this, but there are real consequences to this cultural problem in our politics, isn't there, both domestically and internationally?
Absolutely. It certainly doesn't do anything to help that general disenchantment with politics. It means that you don't have the benefit of having very experienced leaders in the top jobs. Perhaps the best example is a trade deal with Indonesia, which had been carefully negotiated, was ready to sign, but then we had a change of government. The Morrison government made some policy decisions that certainly appeared to happen very quickly and didn't go down well in the region. And now it's not clear when that deal will be signed, even though all the hard work and details are done. So there are great risks to Australia's international relations and to our domestic policies as well when there is this kind of continual churn. There has to be a hope that this kind of stumbling along doesn't keep continuing for yet another decade.
I'm Linda Mottram. Thanks for listening. And our Canberra team today are summing up 2018 for you and looking towards 2019, an election year. But first, on the policy front, one of the toughest nuts to crack has been energy and climate policy. With each incoming PM has come a new approach, or in the case of Malcolm Turnbull, two new approaches. The latest is the so-called Big Stick, championed by Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who will take it to voters next year as one of the centrepieces of his bid to get the coalition re-elected. Here's political reporter Tom Iggledon in Canberra.
Remember this?
Climate change is the great moral challenge of our generation.
That's former Labor Prime Minister Kevin Rudd 11 years ago kick-starting the climate and energy debate. And this is him dumping his emissions trading scheme 2 years later after he couldn't get it through the Parliament.
The implementation of a carbon pollution reduction scheme in Australia will be delayed.
Then came this.
There will be no carbon tax under the government I lead.
After barely winning the 2010 election, Julia Gillard's minority government was forced to break that promise.
We will require around 500 big polluters to pay a price for every tonne of carbon pollution they put into our atmosphere.
She managed to get the carbon tax through the Parliament, but Labor lost the next election and Tony Abbott repealed it.
Today, the tax that you voted to get rid of is finally gone.
Since then, there have been no less than four plans from the coalition over three prime ministers: Tony Abbott's direct action policy, the clean energy target brought in by Malcolm Turnbull, then dumped by him in favour of the national energy guarantee.
Now, what we have today is a game changer.
But it wasn't. He dumped that too in a failed attempt to head off a leadership challenge in August. His replacement, Scott Morrison, has focused his energies on bringing down power prices through what he calls the big stick.
Well, it's everything from enforceable undertakings through the courts through to divestment powers of their assets. So that's a pretty big stick.
Energy Minister Angus Taylor makes no apology for the government putting more emphasis on power prices than reducing carbon emissions.
Because we're going to achieve our emissions reduction target so far ahead of time, this plan is squarely focused on affordable, reliable electricity.
Forcing power companies to sell ageing power plants instead of closing them is at one end of the big stick plan. At the other, the government underwriting the cost of building new power plants. A list of potential projects is expected early in the new year, aiming to fill a projected shortfall in baseload generation as old plants shut down.
The only place you can end up with if you can't implement a market mechanism is for massive government regulation. And that's where we've ended up.
That's Catherine Murphy, political editor at Guardian Australia, who's been following the politics of climate change and power generation for years.
OK, government intervention, that's why we have governments. Perhaps it's not quite as crazy as I think it is, but it is pretty crazy.
We're doing it in a specific industry for a specific period of time, through to 2025, just 7 years, for specific practices, which is particularly around withdrawal of supply from the market, which hikes prices.
Power companies are lobbying hard to stop that from happening. Sarah McNamara is the CEO of the Australian Energy Council.
There remain serious issues with the constitutionality and the detail in this bill.
Sarah McNamara says the power industry understands it has to decarbonise and will take steps on its own if the government doesn't do more to address climate change as part of its energy policy.
And it's deeply disappointing to all of us in the sector that this year has not seen much, if any, progress made towards getting a national climate and energy policy in place.
The Guardian Australia's Catherine Murphy says the government's risking much politically by going to the election without a settled climate change policy.
I think voters are more conscious of the fact that they've kind of been had. I think it is dangerous for the Liberal Party to go into this particular election cycle with nothing sensible to say on climate change. I think it's the wrong time to front up with nothing sensible to say.
Well, they'd argue that their sensible proposition is that their targets agreed at Paris will be easily met.
Yes.
And so we can focus now on power prices.
Isn't that brilliant? If only we knew how they might be met.
The Guardian's political editor, Catherine Murphy, and our political reporter, Tom Eagledon, is with me now. Tom, it's very interesting looking at the trajectory of this energy debate, because when it started, we were talking about climate and how to craft energy policy for the climate change challenge. And now it's morphed almost totally into a discussion about energy prices for consumers. Just how did we get there?
Well, a couple of reasons, I suppose, Linda. The first would be that electricity prices have just kept on going up and up and up over the course of this debate. And part of the reason for that, of course, as you heard in the story just there, is that because of this policy stasis, this paralysis, there's been no certainty for investors. There's been no new investment in power generation. And that's has allowed the government, the coalition, to really zero in on that as a political argument, looking just at that prices side. And of course, the other driving factor here, Linda, on the political side, is the very deep divisions in the coalition's party room over this question of climate change. We've seen every attempt on the coalition side to incorporate that into an energy policy basically come to naught and wash up, crash, if you like, on the rocks of internal division. Perhaps one of the more interesting aspects as we look forward to the federal election is that Labor will now go into that election with a policy that was devised by former coalition Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, that being the National Energy Guarantee, as one of the centrepieces of their energy and climate change policy.
Wow, the cycle of our politics is fascinating, isn't it? So, yeah, we go into the election, but is it still going to be fixed, the discussion about energy policy still going to be fixed around electricity prices, do you think? Or is there room now for the climate change debate to return?
Well, it might be a discussion that the coalition party room, for example, wants to avoid, but it's certainly not a discussion being avoided in many of the electorates that could be seen as pretty key. So, for example, you would have to look at the Wentworth by-election. Did climate change as opposed to power prices play a role in that result? Well, you'd have to probably say yes. And could that be replicated in other seats across the nation? Again, you'd have to say in quite a few of the key marginals, yes. Given that is the case, it'll be crucial to the outcome of the election who gets that balance right, you would think.
In the midst of this leadership turmoil, Canberra has been challenged to face another cultural problem, one with shades of a global trend. It's what the Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins says is a version of the Me Too movement, and it's led to calls from women for the standards in Parliament to be lifted across the board. For a look at why this has unfolded now, here's political reporter Stephanie Boris.
It's a workplace like no other.
Order! There's only 2 minutes to go. Everyone can just take a breath, Senator Cameron.
Politicians are noisy and argumentative when in the chambers of Parliament, but there's a line that's been crossed on a number of occasions this year, and some politicians, including Senate President Scott Ryan, have called it out.
If we cannot debate and act civilly in this chamber, then how can we expect people outside the chamber to debate and argue and disagree respectfully?
In this case, there was uproar in the Senate over Coalition Senator Barry O'Sullivan's comments levelled at Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
There's a bit of Nick Xenophon in her, and I don't mean that to be a double reference, but there's a bit of Xenophon in her, references committees and not attending.
So Senator O'Sullivan, order,
some politicians say there's a lack of respect for women not only on the floor of Parliament but also through the corridors of the building. Usually hidden behind closed doors, it became very public during and after the Liberal leadership spill.
I had senators and ministers in tears. That's how bad it was.
Liberal Senator Lucy Gishui was one of a handful of women to call out bullying within the party, saying some of her colleagues used toxic tactics to try and influence the leadership vote.
Anytime somebody is overpowering you or using any undue influence, that's not political.
While her Senate colleague Linda Reynolds rose to her feet in Parliament to put on the record her disappointment in some people's actions, she called for her party to rise above such behaviour.
I do not recognise the values. I do not recognise the bullying and the intimidation that has gone on.
The strongest message came from Liberal MP Julia Banks, who announced she would not contest the next election, saying she had been subjected to bullying and intimidation from within her own party and the opposition. Speaking on Sky News, then Victorian Liberal Party State President Michael Kroger was initially dismissive of the claims.
Am I aware of anyone who was threatened, bullied, intimidated? No. I mean, would that have happened in the Labor Party when they changed the leadership from Gillard to Rudd and back and forth? Politics is a bit of a rough business.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison was quick to condemn bullying of any kind, and when asked if there would be an investigation into the matter...
Well, the Minister for Women and I have discussed this matter as well today, and I'll continue to do that with Kelly O'Dwyer.
It was the toxic culture that saw Julia Banks announce her plans to quit politics, but it appears a lack of support after her initial decision made her go one step further. Julia Banks telling Parliament she was quitting the Liberal Party and moving to the crossbench effective immediately.
Across both major parties, the level of regard and respect for women in politics is years behind the business world.
The Liberal Party executive has now set up a review of its internal complaints process that will examine the way the party deals with allegations such as bullying and intimidation. And while the focus has been on the treatment of women in the Liberal Party, Labor MP Emma Hussar says Julia Banks's experience is not limited to one political group.
I thought you could take her name out and you know, sort of insert a couple of other names in there too.
Emma Hussar was subjected to an internal party investigation after a series of allegations were levelled against her. It did not uphold claims of sexual harassment and lewd conduct, but it did find she had subjected staff to unreasonable management. The MP believes the culture at Parliament towards women needs to change.
I think the Parliament does have a problem, and I don't think it's an nail NLP problem. I don't think it's a Liberal problem or it's a Green problem. I think it's a men problem.
As to how that problem can be fixed, one former Australian Democrat senator has weighed into the discussion about issues of sexism and bullying. Natasha Stott Despoja was and still is the youngest woman to have served in federal parliament. She's now the chair of Our Watch, a foundation that works to prevent violence against women and their children.
We have to look at how women are portrayed, represented and reflected throughout society, especially in our powerful institutions, and that includes Parliament. So yes, I think that there is a problem when you don't have parity in our decision-making institutions. And yes, I do think there's a problem when our diversity and difference is not reflected and represented, because that will make a difference, definitely on a range of fronts.
Natasha Stott Despoja there, and Stephanie Boris, our reporter, is with me. Because, Steph, I wanted to ask you about the wider issue here, particularly for the Liberal Party, which became really evident this year. And it's that the Liberal Party has this really serious ongoing problem with a lack of female representation. They've really struggled with this. Have they settled on anything that might help them solve it?
When you compare Liberal and Labor parties and the number of women that are in them, they are remarkably different. Just even taking a look at the House of Representatives, for example, there are 11 Liberal women and 29 Labor women.
Oh, now, huge difference, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and that's purely Liberal women. I'm not including the National Party there. So, and in the National Party, there aren't many women either, but that's a story for another day. The difference here between the Liberal and Labor Party in terms of female numbers can, I think, be partly put down to the fact that Labor does have this quota of reaching 50% of women in the party by 2025, and they're nearly already at that goal. So as to whether quotas should be introduced in the Liberal Party, there are very mixed views still, but there are a growing number of people actually calling for them, more so than what we used to see. But the thing is, senior ministers, including the Prime Minister, argue it's about selecting the best candidate for the job, so I can't see any changes happening anytime soon.
Indeed, it's also worth noting, of course, just how remarkable things were as Parliament came to an end this year. We had the spectre of bills on Nauru and the encryption laws on the brink of being passed, and interwoven in all of that was the newly emerging power of the independents. How important will they be as we head into an election year?
I think it's definitely making the government's job harder. You would have seen in the past few years that the government had to deal with a crossbench in the Senate. That's where the issue was when it came to getting legislation through Parliament. But now, with the crossbench growing in the House of Representatives, it means they have a pretty big task on their hands, because this all comes down to numbers and counting and exactly what the crossbench want in order to ensure that the government also gets what it wants.
And Melissa Clark, I bring you in here. We know that issues like a National Integrity Commission and an Ethics Commissioner, which Cathy McGowan has been pushing, have been getting a lot of traction. The government has latterly got on board with that as well. How much can we expect these independents to flex their muscles when Parliament returns in February?
They will certainly be pushing hard on those issues. There are two big impulses here. One of them is the fact that the crossbenchers realise that they have a limited amount of time in which to try to make an impact. Once we get to the next election, we don't know what the outcome will be, and it's possible that sitting on the crossbench won't put them in a position of power. They realise that this is a window of opportunity at which they can try to force the hand of the government on issues. So they will try and push very hard between now and whenever the election is called.
And I think the jaded electorate narrative is interesting too. If you look at the Victorian state election, you know, the Labor government re-elected very, very strongly, and the commentary in very broad terms being, well, they had a good narrative to sell and they sold it well. So, you know, the voters came out and said, yeah, we'll have that, thanks very much. I wonder what kind of a campaign we can expect, and I guess what the basic, you know, stories will be from the two sides.
Well, let me start off here, because I watched the Victorian election pretty closely, and it is certainly the case that the Victorian public responded well to a very centrist focus in policy sense from the Andrews Labor government. They pushed big on things like infrastructure, on congestion, on very day-to-day matters. They weren't as focused as we often see at a federal political level on social social signalling issues. So they weren't talking about safe schools as much as, say, their federal counterparts do, even though it's something that falls in a state jurisdiction. And I think the federal counterparts will be looking very closely at that when seeing this is what has led to a strong reaction from the Victorian public, a negative campaigning approach from Matthew Guy as the Liberal opposition leader clearly didn't resonate and wasn't enough to address what are legitimate law and order concerns in Victoria. The extent and the overreach of that campaign wasn't one that was successful. So I would expect that our federal counterparts might well take a lesson from that.
Well, we're in for a big year politically, 2019, a federal election year. Stephanie Boris and Mel Clark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks, Linda.
And that's our federal politics edition of How Did We Get Here? I'm Linda Mottram from PM. If you want to revisit any of our programs, all the audio is on our website. Search ABC PM.